Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Good Radio Network, radio that does a world of good. This isn't your average talk radio show. We're blasting away the old tried and not so true mold. Instead, TGRN turns talk into action. And action leads to doing positive things for people, our environment, and even the animals.
Well, I'm only one person. What can I do?
A lot. Join host Frankie Picasso while she turns talk into doing and gets results. This is the Good Radio Network. Yes, you can do it if you try, even if you're just a regular guy. Now, here's your host, Frankie Picasso.
Good day and welcome to the Good Radio Network, radio that does a world of good. It is such an honor to be here with each and every one of you today. I have a little update. Owie Bow Wowie and the 25th of Remember have a new store. They have a new store in Grass Valley, and Gina Woods is so excited that Owie's going to be able to raise more money for all of his friends in the hospital. So congratulations to Gina and Owie Bow Wowie on their new store, because remember, not everybody gets the 25th of December. So today, I have an amazing guest. If he was a major league athlete, he would come with a disclaimer as being a triple threat. He's armed with a degree in psychology. He's a board certified in internal and cardiac medicine. He completed his invasive cardiac fellowship at Cleveland Clinic Foundation. So while Dr. Terry Gordon, retired working in clinic, seeing patients with physical matters of the heart, he did step up his game to treat thousands worldwide as a spiritual heart specialist. He might take note of that. We'll see. In 2002, Terry won the American Heart Association's National Physician of the Year Award, and in 2012, he became the 45th recipient of the Bert A. Polsky Humanitarian Award, an award he won because of his selfless dedication to humanitarian causes in Akron, Ohio. And when a 15-year-old high schooler football player, Josh Miller, collapsed and subsequently died during a hometown football game, Dr. Gordon decided that this would never happen again, passionately and tirelessly to ensure that automated external defibrillators were not only placed in schools across the state of Ohio, but also in police vehicles. And when he took it a step further and spearheaded a national campaign which resulted in legislation being put forth by U.S. Congresswoman Betty Sutton to recreate the Ohio school AED program. And on a national scale, the goal being to place one AED in every school in our country. The Josh Miller Hearts Act passed the U.S. House of Representatives twice, quite a feat. And as a father of four and a heart surgeon who dealt with life and death on a daily basis, Terry came to appreciate just how precious life is when his family experienced firsthand how quickly life can change. His son Tyler was involved in an automobile accident and sustained a severe spinal cord injury that left him paralyzed. And one of the gifts that occurred as a result of this accident is a book that Terry authored titled No Storm Lasts Forever, Transforming Suffering into Insight. And in leading his family through this life-changing experience, Dr. Gordon's journey resulted in a spiritual awakening to a clearer understanding of life and the truth it had to offer. And I know that I feel blessed being with him today, and I look forward to learning more about him and all that he has learned. So welcome, Dr. Terry Gordon, to the show.
Thank you. My name's Terry, by the way.
I did say
not
Terry.
Not this doctor stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, I had to give you the formal, and then I was going to come back to Terry. I mean, you know. You spent a lot of years in school learning that doctor. So let's give you your due there. How's that?
That's fine.
On your website.
How are you today?
I'm wonderful. I am excited. The sun is shining finally. Spring came in with a vengeance. It got very hot, and then it got very cold again, but it's sunshine, and I love it. I wanted to ask you about the wounded warrior. You call yourself the wounded healer.
Wounded healer. Yeah. There have been several people that have described me that way. I didn't describe myself that way. In fact, it made me feel a little uncomfortable when people suggested that. It kind of started when I graduated from medical school. My wife, Angela, crafted for me an embroidery that had the following words on it. It said, "Treat each of your patients as a loved one. feel his pain, his loneliness, his fear. You will suspect everything and miss nothing. Like it or not, you will be loved as you love. And I put that over the door in my office. So every morning when I would leave to go into the hospital, I would be reminded of that mantra. But I have to admit, I kind of strayed away from allowing myself to get too close to patients at first, because I believed that if I were to get too emotionally involved, that it would detract from my ability to take care of them physically.
Mm-hmm.
But I, over the course of a number of years, that posture softened. In Greek mythology, Chiron was the wisest of the centaurs, and while he was in battle, he was wounded by an arrow that had been dipped in Hydra's blood, and he became very ill. And the resultant lifelong anguish that he experienced set him out on a journey of discovery in search of his own cure. But along the way, he discovered how to heal others. And he found that by teaching others the art of healing, he himself found a haven of healing for himself. Chiron came to understand what his patients were experiencing because he himself had felt the same pain. And you know, Frankie, I used to think that I shouldn't get too emotionally involved. My mother, even years ago, had suggested that I shouldn't become a doctor because I wouldn't be able to handle losing a patient.
Oh.
But I learned, although activating the experience makes it perhaps more efficient in the way you treat the patient, it also mm-hmm. removes a very important part of the mix, and that is the humanity from the service to others.
Mm-hmm.
Carl Jung explained it this way. The doctor is effective only when he himself or herself is affected. Only the wounded physician heals. So what I morphed into was one that threw myself and my emotion and my love into taking care of my patients. And I truly loved every single one of them. And I found that because I had been in pain, because I was suffering, I could be a better healer. So that's where I think, at least in my circumstance, that's where the wounded healer comes in. And anybody can be a wounded healer. You don't have to be a physician or a doctor.
Yes.
Anybody that touches another life.
That makes a lot of sense. I said that makes a lot of sense. And
mm-hmm.
I understand wanting to take yourself out of the equation because it can be painful to lose a patient. To treat them clinically. But when you care about them, you're going to do maybe a better job. You know, recently my dad had triple bypass and a valve replacement at 96, and otherwise he was in great shape. And I saw him. He's a consummate salesman, and he looked at the doctor and he shook his hand and he goes, "I have faith in you. I have faith that you are going to do a fantastic job, and I'm going to be back here talking to you tomorrow." And, you know, in 4 days that man was out of the hospital walking around. Amazing.
Isn't that
more? Yeah.
You know, so much of it is attitude, you know.
It really is.
What you go into it with, you know, the people that, you know, that I would send to surgery that went into it with a woe is me victim sort of attitude did not do as well as those people that said, okay, come on, let's get it over with. I got things to do.
Yes. Yes. And that's absolutely the key to survival. It really is. And so you said that you have... I was reading that you have a mantra that says, "I give myself away every day."
Mm-hmm.
And that is so beautiful.
Well, it's what I don't know. You know, my even Tyler, my son, would often say, you know, "Dad, you know, you work so hard and then you do all this other stuff and you're, you know, don't you ever do anything for yourself?" And believe it or not, the more you give away of yourself, you know, it's like a boomerang. It just, and that's not why you do it. But it comes right back, and I, every day that I gave myself away every day, I was energized by that, and by the next morning, I was ready to do it again. It just became so natural, and it's such a wonderful way, rather than being selfish and doing everything for yourself. It's so marvelous just to give it away, you know? It's a blessing.
Have you always had that kind of spiritual outlook on life? Not a religious outlook, but a spiritual outlook?
Yeah, you know, I think so. It's, you know, at different times in my life, it's been, you know, covered with stuff. But, yeah, I've always kind of had that love of people. I mean, you know, in nursery school, first time I ever got slapped in the face, it was in nursery school because I just, you know, I just love people, you know, and I was known as a kissing bee. You know, in today's world, you got to be careful, but it's so funny because when I would come home, when I come home from work at night, my wife goes, you know, trying to sniff to see who it is that I've been kissing because, you know, I would kiss all these little old ladies. But yeah, I just always have felt this love for everybody, and it's, you know, it didn't matter who they were, what station in life they were, where, you know, what color their skin was. I just have always had that love for people and still do.
Well, you did an absolutely amazing thing. You know, one of the premises for a guest coming on the show, and the reason I started the show, because I really wanted to tell people or show people that anybody can change the lives of others. Anybody can change the world. And even if you're one person, as the intro said. And so I wanted to make it my mission to go out into the world and find all these different people who had said, what can I do? What can I do to change the world? And, I mean, I know you probably did it a million more times than this one time, but when you read about the young man who you know, had the heart attack on the field from a football game, and you said, I'm going to do something. This is ridiculous. Like, this should never have happened. And you started this, your project, and you know, making sure that these AEDs got into school, you know, beginning in Ohio. How did you do that? Because I think one of the biggest questions is that people say, well, how can I, what, I don't know what to do. How do I know what to do? How do I start something? I have an idea, but how do I do it? So how did you do it?
Well, it was a life changer for me because I unfortunately had the opportunity to watch the video of Josh's death, and it was sickening. It, you know, it was like watching a movie that you had seen 1,000 times, and you knew exactly how it was going to end, and yet you were helpless to make it end any other way. And it was in that normally boisterous stadium that you could hear a pin drop, except for the wail of his mother. And it was a sound, Frankie, that continues to reverberate in my soul. And I was then president of the local chapter of the American Heart Association, and I vowed we weren't going to let that happen, and we were going to do something about it. And my idea was to raise the money to put an AED in every junior in high school in our community. And people told me I was crazy, and that's all I need to hear. And by the way, I am crazy, but all I need to hear is that I can't do it. And so I went about approaching people, even if they said no, and we raised $300,000 to do this. And we trained 12 people in each school to use the AED and learn how to do CPR. And then once we succeeded in that, I thought, well, wait a minute. What about the next county and the next county after that? So it was actually a very interesting thing that happened. I had gone to D.C. to lobby for a national bill. Now, I didn't know what I was doing. And I just went there, and I'm knocking on doors and talking to whomever would speak to me. And it became very clear that I wasn't going to succeed this way. And it was on the way home and on the airplane. And I remember I was meditating, and I was just thinking, you know, I've got all this energy. Direct me. Show me what I'm supposed to do. And the vision popped into my head, excuse me, of this gentleman in town. And I didn't know him. I didn't know what political affiliation he had. I just knew of him. And so that night I called him and I said, you know, his name's Dave Brennan. I said, I would really like to talk with you for a few moments, if I may. He said, well, come on over for breakfast tomorrow morning. So I went over to his house and I'm showing him pictures of all the kids who had died of sudden cardiac arrest and telling a little bit of his story, each of the young kids. And about halfway through my presentation, he leaned up and gently closed the book. He said, Terry, you don't need to sell me on this. This is a noble mission. Cut to the chase. What do you need? And I took a deep breath. I said, Mr. Brennan, I need $5 million. And he leaned back and kind of looked off in the distance. He said, okay, this is how we're going to do it. And it unfolded exactly as I had seen it in my vision, in my meditative state. And the very day that we succeeded in that, we put, it was like 4,470 some odd AEDs in schools throughout the state of Ohio, K through 12, public, private, parochial, charter. And we've had to date at least 20 saves. We had our most recent one was a sixth grader saved by one of these AEDs. And it's just, you know, it's just one of those things that it was the right thing to do. And then Betty Sutton grabbed it. She was our U.S. Congresswoman, and within 6 months it had passed the U.S. House of Representatives. Unfortunately, did not make it through the Senate. She got it passed again through the House, and once again did not make it through the Senate. So we're still working on it. It hasn't passed yet, but
that amazes me that it doesn't, that it hadn't passed through. And it amazes me because football, especially football, is such a huge, huge thing in the United States in high school. I mean, everybody's a star if you play football. And well, you know, you watch movies of these kids being worked to death on the field, be it baseball or football or whatever sport they're playing. And it just amazes me that it wouldn't pass. It boggles the mind. So what are the statistics, like, in were your statistics for Ohio specifically or throughout the United States of kids who are dying in school?
Well, sadly, across the country. And since the bill first passed the U.S. House of Representatives, 280 children have died of cardiac arrest in our schools.
Goodness.
That's how frequent this happens. It's not an infrequent thing. And it's not just football. It's usually during exertion, but it could be volleyball. It could be sitting in class, you know. So there are many, many causes. It knows no socioeconomic barrier, no racial barrier, no gender barrier. There are just as many young ladies that collapse of sudden cardiac arrest. And this is a device that can cure it. You know, every year in America, 250,000 Americans collapse of sudden cardiac arrest, and 95% of those die. And the reason being is that for every minute that someone is in a cardiac arrest, and that's where the heart's just quivering without beating effectively, every minute that goes on, that person's chance of survival drops by 10% every 60 seconds. Nationwide, the average response time of paramedics is about 8 to 12 minutes. So if you do the math, that's why such precious few survive. But if you do CPR, it doubles the chance of survival from 3 to 5% to 6 to 10%. If you do CPR and shock with a defibrillator within 2 to 3 minutes, upwards of 50 to 60 to 70% of those people will survive. So it's a no-brainer.
Wow.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Now, the travesty is that while those 280 children were left unprotected because the Senate didn't pass it, if you walk through the halls of the Senate and the halls of the United States Congress, guess what? AEDs are everywhere. 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 So that's the travesty and the tragedy. So we're still working on it, and it will, you know, it's like my buddy Wayne Dyer taught me from his book, The Power of Intention. You know, my intention, I see it as done. It's already there. I just got to figure out a way to get to it, but it's already there.
Done deal. Well, we'll join you on that.
Good.
we'll put our intention with you, and we'll get people to intend that. It's a noble cause. It certainly is. What amazing. And you got them into the police vehicles as well, which was great.
Yeah. You know, when 80% of law enforcement responds to medical emergencies, and 60% of the time they get there before the paramedics do, and if they have an AED, they can shock the patient 3.5 minutes quicker than if you wait for the paramedics. Now, what that means is that if you're shocked by a cop, you have a 10 times greater chance of walking out of the hospital unscathed than if you wait for the paramedics. You know, what we've done, the American Heart Association, Red Cross and whatnot, you know, we've trained people very well. Call 911. But if that's all you do, guess what? You're going to lose most of those people. You've got to start CPR, and you have to deliver that shock. So the more places that AEDs are placed, especially in mobile units like police cars, highway patrol, and sheriff's vehicles, the greater the chance of saving a life.
Here, I think the fire truck shows up first.
Well, you know, how long does it take for a fire truck to get there if a cop happens to be right around the corner?
Exactly.
And that happened here in our community. There was a guy who was a plumber, knocked on the door of a person he was coming to see and had a cardiac arrest. They called 911, but the cop was right around the corner and was able to get his AED to the man and shock him within 45 seconds. Now, it doesn't always work.
Terry, what kind of damage is done to the heart? Well, with a shock.
Well, you can't get any deader than you are when you're in a cardiac arrest.
Right.
So the defibrillator doesn't damage the heart. And it's like, you know, it's like the defibrillators you've seen. They put the paddles on and shock. This is a device that anybody can use. You could pick this thing up and figure it out because it's voice prompting. It tells you what to do. And if you don't do it, It keeps telling you what to do until you do. We trained paramedics and seventh graders in the use of this unit, and it took the seventh graders a whopping 29 seconds longer to figure it out. It's so simple.
Wow.
It's voice prompts, and there's one button generally to turn the unit on, and after that, it does what it's supposed to do.
So what's
a no-brainer. Well, they're about $1,000, $1,100, $1,500, depending on the bells and whistles. There are a number of companies that make them now, probably six or seven. My recommendation is get the simplest one. It's automatic, where you just turn it on and it just tells you what to do. It tells you where to put the patches, and then it cycles through and you don't have to push any more buttons. But they're relatively, I mean, you think about the cost of an ambulance ride would easily pay for an AED.
Right.
And yet if you wait, do you remember Tim Russert? He was with NBC. He was on Meet the Nation. You remember him? He was one of the... He had a cardiac arrest in the NBC studio.
Oh.
And they ran and got the AED and put it right next to him and waited for the paramedics to get there to use it.
No.
And he died.
Oh, heartbreaking.
Yeah. So it's very important that you have it, you know how to use it, you keep people educated that it is there,
right,
and check the batteries, and hopefully you'll never need it, but it is definitely a lifesaver, no question about it.
Let's talk about your good friend, Wayne Dyer. He wrote the intro to your book. He describes you as his doctor and his best friend.
I love him dearly. Well, I had a patient that kind of called me on it one day. I walked into his room. I was a very busy cardiologist. And, I mean, I would see 40 people in the hospital and be over in the office by 1:30 after doing six or seven heart catheterizations. So I walked into this guy's room, and he took one look at me and said, "Dr. Gordon, you're killing yourself." And I said, "I beg your pardon?" He said, you're killing yourself. You've got all this marvelous energy about you, but it's all fractured. Man, you better do something about it." And one of the things he suggested is that I read a couple of books by Dr. Wayne Dyer. And I had read, I think, Your Erroneous Zones years and years ago by him, but
right,
hadn't picked anything else up. And the book he suggested was Real Magic and Inspiration. And I read those books. They really resonated with me. And I tried to call Wayne Dyer just to thank him for impacting my life in such a way, and never got in touch with him. And a couple of years later, my wife Angela and I took a trip to Hawaii. And right before we left, Angela developed shingles, and it was a terrible case. And so, you know, somehow she made it out there. I don't know how she did, but she made it out there, and she was sick in bed for the first three or four days. And one morning I went out on the beach and tried to meditate and couldn't, and was trying to run, and it just wasn't working. And I was coming back to the room kind of kicking the sand, feeling sorry for myself. And guess who I bumped into? Wayne Dyer, you know? And you know, what are the chances of that happening? And I walked up to him. I'm sorry?
So the universe has had to make some arrangements.
They did. So I walked up to him and I said, "Man, I know you're on vacation and I don't want to bother you, but I just want to thank you for saving my life." And he said, "Really? Tell me about it." So for 20 minutes, I'm the most important guy in the world to Wayne Dyer. And, you know, it came out that he had just had an angioplasty and a stent. And I told him, "Well, I'm a doctor that does that sort of thing." So he said, "Well, why don't you come over here and let's talk?" So we started this friendship and became we're like brothers. And little did I know, Frankie, that not-so-chance meeting was purposeful. And he was placed in my path for a reason, and that reason was to help me endure what we were about to endure. And that kind of unfolded in 2009. It was June 29th, and I was up in the office of my home doing a little work, and my daughter, Maddie Rose, who was teaching in Chicago, had just driven in for the weekend. And she walked into my office, and I could tell something was up. And, you know, it's a parent's sixth sense when you just know something's not quite right. And she had this sadness dripping from her. And I said, "Well, what's up, sweetie?" And she came around my desk and plopped herself down at my feet and put her arms up on my knees. And she said, "You know, Dad, I always thought that the older I got, the more control I assumed over my life, the easier life would become." And then with this deep sigh and a single tear trickling down her cheek, she said, "You know, it's just not working out that way, Dad." And I pulled her up into my arms, and I started to rock her as I had for 27-some-odd years. And I paused for a very long time because I knew what I was about to say to her would be very important. And I said, you know, darling, I think that's the way it's supposed to be. If we are to grow, if we are to progress, if we are to mature spiritually, we must face greater and greater obstacles, because it's only by overcoming those obstacles that we reach a higher place. And I shared with her a quote from the Kabbalah, which is the ancient mystical text of Judaism. And in the Kabbalah it says, it's the falls of our life that provide us the energy to propel us onto a higher path. It's the falls of our life. And I left her with one final thought as I kissed her on the forehead, and I said, you know, sweetie, we should actually be grateful for the crap that comes our way.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning at 6:40, I received one of the worst phone calls a parent could get. The grave voice on the other end of the line shared with me that our son Tyler, who was in school out in Durango, Colorado, had been involved in a single car accident, and he had flipped his car over and over and over, and that he had shattered his neck. And then came the dreaded words, your son is quadriplegic. Well, you know, you worry about that sort of phone call. You fret when your kids don't come home when they're supposed to, or come home in a condition you're not particularly proud of. But you can't imagine the impact of those words when you actually hear them. And I was frozen for just about 20 seconds. I had about 20 seconds of denial, and then the doctor in me kicked in. I knew where we were going with this, what was going to happen. They were getting actually ready to life flight him from Durango, Colorado to Denver, where he would have to go undergo emergency surgery. So within an hour of getting the phone call, I had hastily packed a bag, bolted from the house, and I'm speeding up to the airport to try to get on this overbooked flight that would get me to Denver in time to see Tyler before he went into surgery. And, you know, I got up there. There were 8 people ahead of me on the wait list. And I don't know how, but I got on that flight. And they placed me next to a window. So now I'm incommunicado. I don't know if Tyler's alive, dead, brain damaged, bleeding out. And I felt like a caged cat. And the thoughts were just banging away in my skull. It was so painful. It was the most frightening time in my life, Frankie. I felt like I was in this tornado. And in this tornado, it was loud, and it was whooshing, and it was dark, and it was dank, and it was noisy. And I looked down the funnel, and it was just pure blackness. And as I kept getting sucked deeper into this funnel, I kept saying, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't. And gradually, this loud whooshing sound started to abate. As I became enveloped in this cocoon of white noise, strand by strand, and it became this place of unfathomable peace, but I still was saying, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't. And I won't tell you I heard the voice of God, but from somewhere deep inside, I heard God. And God said, yes, you can. I said, but I don't have the tools. I don't know how to do this. I know I can't do this. And God reminded me, Terry, just last night, you shared your truth with your daughter, Maddie Rose. You can talk the talk, but now you're going to have to live it. And I said, but how do I do this? And God reminded me that everything is in perfect order. Even this is in perfect order. And when I asked once again, how do I manifest this? God shared with me the most profound thought I have ever contemplated in my life. When God said, treat this as if it was something you had chosen. Now, why would I do that?
Yeah.
Why would I choose such a horrific injury for my son? Maybe for me, but why for my son? And as you know, there are many religions that promote the thought that we actually choose what it is we are to experience in a particular lifetime.
Right.
And that choice is predicated on what our individual and unique spirit needs. So as I started to navigate this tragedy, which morphed into something more, much more than a tragedy. In fact, tragedy is not a good term to use at all. But what I came to was navigating the storm in our lives. The challenge initially for me became adjusting my perception enough of Tyler's injury to recognize the presence of God within the experience.
Let me ask you something.
What's that?
Sorry. I wanted to ask, when you were saying, I can't do this, was it, I can't see my son like this, I can't fathom looking after him like this, what, when you said, I can't do this, see your child hurt, what did you mean?
It was overwhelming to me. I just didn't think I had it in me to do any of it, you know? I envisioned, you know, I've got to help my wife, I've got to help my daughters, I've got to help my aging mother. I have to help everyone get through this. I have to help me get through this. And I didn't think I had it. And that's when God said, the game changer, treat this as if it was something you had chosen. You know, Wayne often says, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change.
Right.
I forever would have looked at the, woe is me. Why is this happening to us? We don't deserve it. But when you look at it as purposeful, you look at the obstacle, and the greater the obstacle, the greater the potential for growth. That's changing the thought big time.
Right.
And it changed everything. And almost in a nanosecond that happened. I still had doubts, no question about it. And I still was frightened as I could be. But I somehow knew that it was going to be okay. I somehow knew
Were you able to sell that philosophy to your family?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Frankie. We each, when Tyler's accident occurred, we each were at different places, you know? No one is alike in how far along the spiritual journey you are. And so it has affected each of us in different ways. But I think that it has, I have been able to help my family navigate this. And I continue to, because, you know, it's been a rocky road in many respects. You know, my wife is still quite ill, and Tyler is, you know, physically not doing great, but spiritually he's doing marvelous.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about different religions, and your wife, I know, believes in angels, and I'm a metaphysical hypnotherapist, and I take people on their past life journeys. And when I think about if it was chosen, to think about it as if it was chosen and as if Tyler had been like your greatest friend and said, I'm going to do this for you, Terry and Angela. I'm going to make the sacrifice that you guys can go through this experience. That's an amazing way to think about it.
It's an awesome... actually, my wife shared with me that she believed Tyler chose to have this accident so the book could get written, that it could help other people. And it is, and he realizes that.
Right.
You know, he realizes that he has had a great impact on, and continues to. I mean, I have learned so much from this young man. You can't imagine so much. I mean, he's grown in ways he couldn't imagine. And there would be no other way that he could have grown this way. You know, you know, when life is cushy, you don't do a lot of growth.
That's right.
It's the falls of our life that provide us that.
You know, the Chinese have two characters for change. One is danger, the other is opportunity. And I think that's brilliant. You know? Change happens best in chaos. I think change happens best in chaos, and we grow from that. We become our best self, and we become focused. In that.
Carl Perkins said, if it weren't for the rocks in its bed, the stream would have no song. And that's the effect of the obstacles along our path. They actually enrich the experience. And if you can be grateful for the crap that happens, rather than lamenting the fact that it has occurred, if you can be grateful for it, that's the key.
Right.
And it's all in what you decide to focus. It's, you know, we all have the choice. We can either, you know, we can either victimize ourselves and feel sorry for ourselves and lick our own wounds, and the result of that is we suffer, or we can be grateful. We can be thankful that that we got the opportunity to rise above such a...
But one thing I want to bring up, though, is it as horrific it is for Tyler to be a quadriplegic, the caregiver burden is often overlooked. And it is a big role that you play and your other children play and your wife plays. You know, it's hard for people to complain as a caregiver because, you know, what are you going to do? You have a child that needs you. But at the same time, it is it's a big impact on you. And so how do you care for yourself? How does your family care for itself?
Well, second day we were there, we met with Craig Hospital, which was where they took Tyler for his surgery. The second day we met with the psychologist, and the first thing out of this guy's mouth was the caregivers have to take care of themselves. Because if you don't, you're no good for anybody. It's difficult to do. And I will tell you, my wife is not as good at it as I am. You know, my writing takes me into this marvelous place, and so it's definitely taken a toll. There's no question about that. But Angela will say, you know, it's my sacrifice. I'm willing to sacrifice my entire life for my son. But it's difficult. There's no question about it. About a year. I'm sorry.
No, I said right, but I'm thinking, does it have to be a sacrifice? Does it have to be a sacrifice? You know.
Well, see, I don't look at it that way. You know, I'm there for my son. I'm here all the time, and I lovingly do whatever he requires. But I also know that, you know, especially as the leader of the band here, I've got to take care of myself, because if I don't, you know, I'm not going to be good for anybody. And about a year into our ordeal, we've been back home for about a year, and it was not a good circumstance, I can tell you. You know, Tyler initially was very angry, as you can imagine, and things were just very horrific. And my father died of prostate cancer, and so I've always been very vigilant with my PSAs, and my PSA started climbing a little bit. Now, it was still normal, but it was climbing. And my urologist said, well, you know, what do you want to do, Terry? And I said, you know, I think I want a biopsy. He said, well, you know, 80% of them are negative, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have it or don't. And I said, you know what? I just think I want a biopsy. Now, mind you, the PSA was still normal. So he does the biopsy, and it comes back positive. And you know how you think you're going to respond to the diagnosis of cancer?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't respond that way. I remember looking up at the ceiling of the room I was in, thinking, "Okay, God, obviously you think, despite what we're facing right now, that I can handle this." You know, so I guess, you know, I guess I'm supposed to be able to handle this. So that was the attitude I went into it with. But the other thought that I had, I felt like a little boy who had gotten caught with his hand in the cookie jar, and I'll explain why.
Yeah.
I knew that the toxicity that I was allowing into my being was what allowed the cancer cells to grow. So it was a very critical and important learning lesson for me. I've got to be able to change that. And again, that's not something I would normally change unless I was facing something. And, you know, it's a well-known fact that when people are under stress, that the immune system suffers and allows cancerous cells to flourish.
Right.
So it was a very important lesson that I learned about taking care of oneself.
Absolutely. You know, I had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Bruce Lipton. And he's awesome. He's like a runaway freight train. But, you know, he talks about these imaginal cells that we have, and we can create any experience within them that we want, healthy cells. And I truly believe that. I really do. You know, you look at Dr. Emoto's work with water, and you think our body's 75% water. Why wouldn't we have horrible misshapen cells when we think negative thoughts.
Absolutely.
You know, it's, now, you mentioned that you meditate a lot. Mm-hmm. And you, how long have you been doing that for?
Well, ever since I started reading Wayne Dyer's books, because that patient I was telling you about, he suggested two things, that I read a couple of books by Wayne Dyer and that I learn how to meditate. And I had dabbled with it back in the 70s, you know, but I didn't need that now because I'm in control, you know. So I took a transcendental meditation course, and the kids just had a blast making fun of me. They called me Old Farta Swami. And but you know, it was, you know, I've always been a very happy person, but I've never been at peace.
Uh-huh.
Happy, but not at peace. And right. What I found with meditation is I found a way to get to that peace, and it's by going within. I'd never done that before.
A lot of
and
people have a hard time meditating.
They do, they do. But I can tell you, if I can do it, anybody can do it, because my mind is, you know, always going a million miles an hour, and I was
right.
able to harness that. I was able to put a lasso around that, and find this place of unfathomable peace. And
not
it,
just
it was
peace.
Funny.
You're connected to the divine. You hear what the universe is saying to you.
Absolutely, and you, as you know, you don't hear that when you're talking or when your mind's talking. You know, you've got to be at in this place of serenity, and so yes, it's been very, very helpful for me.
Do you have any words of advice on how to do that?
Well, there's so many ways of meditating. I mean, I found that I can meditate in the middle of a conversation, you know, and I'm not ignoring that person. You know, I just get to this zone, this place of higher consciousness, but it's just this place of no thoughts. But there's so many different ways. You know, the transcendental meditation.
It's how I meditate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the trance state, obviously. Get into any trance state, really meditation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you
some
know,
people
and
when they run, some people can't sit still. They need to run
sure.
or do something physical to meditate.
Sure. But, you know, in TM, they give you this mantra to repeat.
Okay.
But, you know, the rosary is a mantra.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people that pray the rosary, they don't think about the words they're saying because it's rote memory. I mean, they've learned it, they've said it so many times. It's a mantra. So there's so many ways to get to that peaceful state, using the rosary or using a mantra or running or whatever it might be. You know, conscious breathing. There's just so many ways, but it's so. I mean, you read any religious book, and all they talk about. I mean, meditation is in all of those texts.
Right.
It's just such an important thing, and we get away with it, away from it.
So what were your numbers today? Is that cancer? Is it gone?
Oh yeah, I ended up having surgery, and you know, they got everything, and it's doing well. So, but you know, it's just one of those. It was not at all the way I expected to handle it. You know, it just was okay. This is what I'm, you know, what I'm facing today. I'm gonna take care of it and move on.
So, do you believe that God doesn't give us more than we can handle? Do you believe that?
I never
thing?
Used to. I in fact, I used to think that was a bunch of bunk. But
uh-huh.
I really believe it's true. I really, and that's the way I have gone through this, that regardless of what has happened since the accident, regardless of what is going on, I changed the thought. And instead of trying to run away from it and keep those things from happening, it's almost like I'm anticipating it, not that I want it, but
right.
knowing that I can handle it. I'm sorry?
Right. I should bring it on. I feel like
well,
that
yeah,
someday.
But,
like, why do you give me so much to bear? Like, come on, give it to somebody
yeah.
else. Not that I want somebody else to have it, I don't. But, you know, some days the challenges are so great that you go, okay, come on, be fair. But in your book, you said life is fair. It is fair to get these things.
It is. It's a gift. This crap that happens to us is a gift. It's a gift from the divine. And if you look at it like that, there are no missteps. There are no mistakes. There are no accidents. Everything is purposeful, and it depends on what you do with it, you know.
Right.
I mean, most of us think in terms of duality. You know, there's good, there's bad, there's hot, there's cold, but they're really one and the same. you know, darkness is just a paucity of light. It's not different from light. It's just a paucity of light. And so when you are faced with something of this magnitude, you have a choice. You know, you either embrace it and learn every single thing you can from it, or you resist it, and then it's painful and it causes suffering.
Right.
So if you, you know, my feeling is if you can take anything, if you can learn anything from an experience, it is not a negative experience. And looking at it that way, there's no such thing as a negative experience. You know, it's a blessing in disguise, a catalyst for change, fodder for growth.
Right. Yes. I
like that. The difficulty is freeing ourselves from the attachment to the good experiences, as well as freeing ourselves of the aversion to the negative ones. That's the key. You've got to accept them both as what is, and learn everything
now,
you can from them.
You talk a lot, in my own book I talked about, too, about the body is just a vehicle that we drive while we're here, because so many people, whether they've had a horrific accident or they're just aging, they fight the process tooth and nail. They fight the ego, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at a site yesterday for some reason that came up with so much disfigurement from plastic surgery, and it's like, why did you do that to yourself? Why did you go and do that? You looked fine. And so what is it you think that we need to learn from this as far as this vehicle that we drive? Some were blessed with better looking ones than others. Some were, you know,
I'll tell you what Wayne said early into Tyler's accident. And God love him, he called every day. He said, just remind Tyler he is so much more than his body. And unfortunately, in our society, in our world, you know, we place far too much emphasis on the vehicle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The catchy term, we're spiritual beings having but a temporary human experience. You know, it's the exterior, which is important to the ego, is temporary. You know, it's something that is fragile. It's can be affected irreversibly by disease and injury and even by our thoughts. You know, it's an ego encapsulated in skin housed in this thing we call a body. And that body has a finite time to be here. And if we spent half the time nurturing our spiritual side as opposed to what we do for our physical side, we would all be in a much, much better place. But you do have to let go of the ego. And it's interesting because, you know, inside each of us, there are two beings. One is the one I just described, that physical being. The other one is an immortal being. It's the authentic self. It's the self that resides in a place of much higher consciousness. And one of the things that I've been able to do is I've been able to transcend to that place of higher consciousness where I'm a passive observer. I have no agenda. I have no judgment, no interference. It's just passive observation. And it's in that place that I can watch Tyler in a different way than I watch him when I am in the physical plane.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm in the physical plane, you know, I'm a father who just is watching his son endure an ocean of suffering. And it is very sad. When I'm in this other place every one of us can get to, this place of higher awareness, I just watch passively as he's going through it, and I can see where he's headed. And I can see my wife from this place, and I can see where she is headed. And the strangest thing, Frankie, is that when I'm in this place of higher consciousness, I can also watch myself as my physical self is going through this.
Right.
And I think what's going to happen one of these days, I'm going to be in that place of higher awareness as I watch myself die.
Right. And you will.
And I will.
And
that body will die. But the spirit doesn't. The spirit continues on.
When you're... when I take people to past life, it's one of the things we do is we watch their death, and you know, without the pain associated to it, and you watch this and you ask that self, that past self, you know, do you have words of wisdom for the present self, and vice versa, and it's a beautiful thing. What comes, it really is absolutely amazing. But you know, when I had my own accident and I lost everything that was, you know, physical in that, my job and being a drummer in a band and being a part of a motorcycle, all those things that we think define us, and I'm sure Tyler has gone through this as well, all of that is gone, and you go, well, who am I? If I'm none of that stuff anymore, who am I? What is my purpose? And his purpose is this. Dad teaching everybody. Mm-hmm. Dad teaching the world about consciousness. Interesting.
Well, you know, but it's again, one of those things that you would have never contemplated had you not been given the gift of the accident.
No, no. And I knew, you know, one of the things that I never, ever did was why me. I never said why me. I knew why the accident happened. I always thought, you know, the universe had been calling, and I'm like, what do you want? I don't know what you want from me. Like, just be clear. And then I have this accent. I go, oh, okay, yeah, to take me out, to shut me up, and I could listen and do nothing. I was 100 miles an hour in my life. So it's very interesting. But I don't think that, you know, everybody needs to get whacked like I did or Tyler did to hear. And that's why it's so beautiful that you get to bring these words of wisdom to us. And hopefully people will grasp the nugget of that.
Well, it was very, very therapeutic for me to write it. And like I said, it just, once it just started flowing. It was never a chore. I never had to struggle. It just came, you know, and I started seeing things totally different and enjoying nature and learning from nature. It just has taught me so much, and it's been my godsend, actually. It really has.
We're listening to Dr. Terry Gordon. Terry, you also have a daily affirmation and a monthly newsletter. Tell people how they can sign up for that. I signed up for that.
Well, they can go to my website. It's www.drterrygordon.com. And Dr. is just D-R. There's no period behind the D-R. And Terry is T-E-R-R-Y. Gordon is G-O-R-D-O-N .com. And I would encourage you to do that. I'm also on Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and Pinterest and all those too under Dr. Terry Gordon.
And you're out there as a speaker, a motivational speaker and inspiration.
Yeah.
You also have
a
new book.
I love doing that.
What's your new book?
Well, I'm sorry, a new book?
Oh.
Well, the first book was the No Storm Lasts Forever. I've just finished a novel, and just to finish the final edit of that, the novel is My Heart Will Go On and On. And it's a very spiritual novel. It's different from my first book, but it is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
So is it fiction or self-help genre?
No, it's fiction.
Okay.
It was interesting because, and again, this was Wayne's fault too, because I was actually spoke at one of his events out in Maui.
Right.
And he said, you know, Terry, you really have so much to say and a unique way of saying it. Have you ever thought about writing? And I hadn't. So I've always been interested in death, not from a Kevorkian sense, but from a spiritual sense.
Right.
And did a lot of research. And, of course, there are so many books out there. But I thought, you know, coming from a cardiologist would be a good. And so somehow it morphed into a novel where the first half of each chapter was the novel. The second half of each chapter was what I was trying to convey in the first half of the chapter. And people either really liked it or really didn't, so I decided to bifurcate them. And so the novel I've just finished, and now I'm working on the third book, which is, I believe, going to be entitled No Beginning, No End, where there is really no such thing as death. I had this beautiful experience. I had this little old lady. Her name was Audrey. And Audrey had a very sick heart. And I had implanted one of the original implantable defibrillators in her heart. This is a device that when you go into cardiac arrest, it shocks you. Well, she outlived her disease by a decade. I never thought she would make it this long, but she did. And one morning she came into the hospital, and this device was appropriately shocking her, saving her life, and it did so about 80 times that day. Unfortunately, she was awake each time. And it was, despite my efforts, I just couldn't calm her sick heart. And so at the end of the day, she called me into her room, and she said, "You know, Terry, I'm not afraid to die, but I don't want to live like this. Will you turn the device off?" And I said, "Well, you know, Audrey, I will, but you have to understand that the very next time that you have this heart rhythm disturbance, you're going to cross over." And she said, "I understand." So none of her family were in town, so I turned the device off, and I just told her how much, you know, it meant to me to be able to be a part of her life. And I turned to walk away, and she said, "You know, Terry, I just have one more request." And I said, "What's that, Audrey?" And she said, "Will you hold my hand?" And I said, "Well, of course I will, Audrey." So, I've been around thousands of people as they die. I've never had anybody ask me to hold their hand as they die. So I invited the nurse out of the room. I sat down on her bed, and I'm holding her hand. And we're talking about the South. She was from South Carolina, and I'm from Kentucky. And, you know, I'm squeezing her hand, and her hand is responsive to mine. And I could see the heart monitor over her right shoulder as she went into a cardiac arrest. And her eyes kind of fluttered, and she gently rolled into the back of her head, and she peacefully crossed over. And as she did so, she lost her bladder control. So I'm now seated in a pool of her urine, holding her hand, but I couldn't move. It was such a special moment. And I'm looking at this hand, and it was the same hand that I had just been holding. It had the same bones in it, same blood cells, electrolyte. Everything in that hand was the same, except for one thing. The spirit had left the vessel. And in that split second, because I allowed myself to do so, I could feel her energy swirling behind me. And then, poof, it was gone. And I looked back to the hand, and the weirdest thought crossed my mind. You remember the movie E.T.?
Mm-hmm.
You remember when E.T.'s bony finger leaned over and ding, it touched the flower and the flower withered? And then he touched it again and ding, the flower came back to life? It hit me that God had just dinged Audrey. Now, we think we know so much in science. We don't know squat. The one thing we do know is that energy doesn't die. It transforms. It changes. It goes someplace else. And depending upon your religious beliefs, will dictate where that energy goes. But it doesn't die. And from the moment she was dinged, that energy exists forever, for eternity. Much like I believe that energy existed for eternity before she got dinged into this body.
Right.
So if you buy that, for eternity before we get here, for eternity after we leave here, the time that we're here is infinitesimal. Not insignificant, not inconsequential, but infinitesimal. And it just changed the whole way. I have 1,000 regrets now, because there were 1,000 people that I was involved in their death as I was frantically trying to keep them alive, where I really wasn't conscious of what was happening at that moment. So that's where number 3 is hit. I'm sorry?
That was something. I sat with my dog as he passed over. And that was very special to be able to talk and hug him and feel that.
Sure.
I know it's not a person.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. That's amazing. Lessons learned. I have so much I can say to you and learn from you and share with you. I'm just, wow.
Listen to me,
Yeah. We've only got a minute left. And again, we've been speaking to Dr. Terry Gordon, just an absolutely amazing humanitarian. And, we're still there.
My pleasure. I've just really enjoyed
this,
Frankie.
Please visit www.drterrygordon.com to find out more about my guest. Order his book, No Storm Lasts Forever. It is fabulous. And I'm really looking forward to reading your new book. So I hope that you'll send me notice when it's ready so I can share it with our audience here.
I'll do that. I will.
Sounds good. Thank you very much. Everybody, whether you've listened to us live or you're going to listen to the download of this, we certainly appreciate you coming to the Good Radio Network. I know I do, and I'll see you again next week. Thank you so much. Take care, Terry. Bye-bye, everyone.
You too. Namaste.